the final chapter of Hilchot Talmud Torah, the laws of Torah study. The main subject of today's class, of this chapter, the seventh and final chapter of the laws of Talmud Torah, is primarily about the laws of excommunication. Excommunication. And it doesn't seem to be so especially relevant to laws of Torah study. And the reason that it comes in over here, we have to back up a little bit to chapter 6. So chapter 6, the Rambam is talking about the respect that we have to have for the Torah sages. And this seems to be a big part of the laws of Torah study. The way that Torah is studied is not just from a book, but from a teacher. And so there's a culture of respect that we have to have for the teachers of Torah. You see that in especially in Sephardic communities, there's a huge, huge respect and love for their chachamim. They're always running over to kiss the hand of the chacham and have their child kiss the hand of the chacham. In Ashkenazic circles as well, there's a respect for the Talmud Chacham, for the Torah sage. And it's really a respect for the Torah itself. Where there isn't that respect for the Torah sage, what ends up happening is there is a lack of respect for the Torah itself and a distance from Torah. And so it's not about worshiping a person or people or elitism, but rather a healthy respect for the Torah. And these are the people that are embodying Torah. They're the ones who are fully immersed in it. And so we have a respect for these people. And that was chapter 6, got the Rambam on what happens if somebody is very disrespectful to a Torah sage. There is something called excommunication. And in today's chapter, he's going to talk about what exactly is excommunication, what are the mechanics, how does it work, so forth. But that's how he got on the subject of excommunication. And already in yesterday's chapter, in chapter 6, he went through a bunch of things, 24 things, for which the court or the sages will put somebody in excommunication unrelated to Torah study. So just a few examples in case you missed it yesterday, or if you already forgot. Somebody who has a kelev ra, somebody who has a dangerous dog or other animal that he has in his property that's a danger to people, they're going to put this person in excommunication until he gets rid of this animal. Somebody who is called to court, who is summoned to court and refuses to come in the time that he was supposed to come, the court will put him in excommunication until he comes. Somebody who refuses to accept the verdict of the court also is going to receive this excommunication. So it's kind of used as a stick to incentivize somebody to get on board with doing the right thing. That's how we get into the laws of excommunication in laws of Talmud Torah. But we'll see at the end, when we get to the end, that there's a very, very powerful teaching about excommunication, how it gets to the heart of what it means to be a true Torah sage. Wait for it, as they say. Sok Tehillik Rambam. Rambam chapter 7, Laws of Talmud Torah. Number 1, Aleph Chocham Zokin B'Chochma. If you have a wise person. Here's the word is Zokin. Zokin you think of as an old person. But often when the Rambam and the Mishnah and the Talmud, when they use the word zokin, doesn't mean an old person necessarily. It means a person who has acquired wisdom. Zakein, ze shekana chachma. So a wise person, a sage, a Torah sage, but a particularly distinguished sage. So he's zakein b'chachma. And also the nasi is the head of the court, of the Sanhedrin. Av Bezdin, who is his right-hand man. So these are the two top leaders of the generation. Shesorach, who did something that wasn't so kosher and therefore incurs the excommunication. So one of the 24 things that were mentioned in chapter 6. And so they've incurred excommunication. But the law is, because of their stature, Ein Minadin Oisei Befarhesi L'Olam, we don't excommunicate them publicly. We don't do a public takedown of the Chacham, Zakin, or the Nasi. So, of course, we're not to, as mentioned, these 24 things are not, it's not, you know, crimes of, God forbid, of major crimes. Of course, in that case, we don't accord any honor to anybody. But in these particular things where it would be an excommunication, we don't do it publicly. And the reason for that is because we do, not to protect the person, but to protect what they represent. It will be a chilul Hashem, it will be a desecration of God's name, and it will be a desecration, people will have less respect for Torah, and therefore we do it quietly, bitzina, as they say. Elam kenasa kiravam benavat v'chaverav, unless they've done something like Yeravam benavat, the king of Israel and his fellows, who famous story of Yeravam ben Nevat, that he was jealous of the kings of Yehuda. He didn't want anybody going to Jerusalem, and so he set up his own temple with images. And so a person who does that, even though Yeravam ben Nevat, he himself was a great Torah scholar, very, very high level Torah scholar, but this is beyond the pale, and he's not accorded any respect. But if he does other sins, and not at that level, he receives lashes, bitzina, which is, and it's done privately, not made a big stink out of it. This comes from Reish Lakish, by the way. And these laws, by the way, come from Tractate Moed Katan in the Talmud. And the connection to Moed Katan is a tractate that talks about mourning, the laws of mourning. God forbid somebody passes away, the laws of mourning. And there the laws of excommunication appear. And the connection is because, as we'll see, the way that an excommunicated person has to behave is similar to a person who is in mourning. So there in Tractate Moed Katan, you have these various laws. And it's Reish Lakish who says this, and says that when a Navi has stumbled, and Navi usually means a prophet, but here it means referring to this great Torah leader, he should be punished in a way that is you are protecting him, covering him up like the night. And we tell him, you know what, he kaved, and for the sake of your honor, just stay home and repent. So here too, when not only this most prestigious, distinguished sage, but any Torah sage that has done one of these things that excommunication would usually be incurred, the court should not jump to do it. They shouldn't jump to do it quickly. They should try to not do it. And the Hasidim, the pious of the sages, would praise themselves and say that they never participated in ostracizing, excommunicating a Torah sage, even though they would join and participate if it was required to receive lashes, that they would do. Even rabbinic lashes, even when there's not a biblical requirement to give them lashes, only rabbinic, they would join with that, because the excommunication is a much more powerful, even though it's, you know, like you say, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. We know that it's actually quite the opposite in some cases, that words can be more powerful than a physical blow. And so the excommunication is such a powerful tool and of such a devastating effect to the Torah sage, but also to the respect for Torah. And this is why they would try as best they can to stay away from ostracizing the Talmud Chacham and using other means with which to discipline the Talmud Chacham that has done one of the things that incur excommunication. Now, it should be noted that this is not an issue of of you know, sweeping things under the rug and trying to hide the sins of the sages. This is not what this is about, because as we see, they are given the lashes and they are giving any penalty that they would incur, just like any other person. But what we do see is that there is a sensitivity around doing it in a private way when it comes to excommunication, which is a very shameful thing and very shameful for the Torah, that it is avoided to the greatest extent that we can. Now the Rambam gets into what is actual excommunication. We say this person, Mr. So-and-so, will be bishamta. And it comes from the shamtam, comes the word shmama, which is desolation. And vimnidu b'fanav, if he's present, we say this person is excommunicated. V'acherim, and then we'll see that there's two levels of excommunication. There's the shamta and there's the cherim. And so in both cases, you say that either this person is b'shamta or this person is muhram. He is excommunicated. I see that here in the English, they're using the first level as ostracized and the second as excommunicated. That's good. But arur by Allah by Shiva by Nidri. Also the expression arur, which is typically translated as cursed, he is cursed, that includes in it both a curse and an oath and an excommunication. So if they say arur, they're like adding on, not only is he excommunicated, he's also cursed. Number three, v'keitzeh matirin hanidri acherim. How do we undo a ostracism or an excommunication? We say to him, shari lacha umachalach, it is permitted to you, it is forgiven to you. V'imitiru shalai b'fanav. And if they release him from his excommunication and he is not present, then they say so and so is forgiven, so and so is released. Number 4, now what exactly is the ostracized person supposed to do? What is his behavior that is required of him? The answer is that the ostracized person is forbidden to take a haircut and he's forbidden to wash his clothing like a mourner all the days of his ostracism. That's as far as what he does with himself. Now the Rambam talks about what other people are required to do to enforce this ostracism, and he says, "Ein mezamnin alav." We know that when we bench, when we do the blessing after meals, after we've had bread, if you have three adults that have eaten together, there's a little preamble that we do before the benching called zimun, or a mezumen, and so we don't include that person as one of the three. And we don't count him in a minion. So if he was the 10th man for the minion, we wouldn't count him as number 10. We keep looking for a number 10. And we do not sit, if he's sitting in the shul or anywhere else, you're not supposed to sit within 4 cubits of him. I will show you now who... But he's allowed to teach others Torah. And you're allowed to teach him Torah. V'niskar, he is hired. V'soicher, he can hire others to do work. V'meis b'nidui, if he dies and he's still in his state of ostracism. Bezdin sholchom anichan emel al arayinui. So the court sends a stone that is placed upon his coffin as if to say that he is being, he's receiving the penalty of stoning because he died in a state of being muvdal, separated from the community. In other words, in his lifetime, he never made amends. And as we'll see, that a person who repents, the ostracism is removed. Since this person never got around to having his ostracism removed because of he failed to make amends, so the stone is placed upon his coffin as a symbol of a stoning and a expiation for him not having made amends with the community. I saw another interpretation that the stone represents stubbornness, that his heart was like stone and he refused to come around. And this is why we place the stone upon his coffin. And it need not be met, be said that we do not eulogize this person, nor do we escort his bier. Number five, Yisur Alav Hamuchram Sheinu Sheinu L'Achirim. Okay, so that's kind of the lower level ostracism. And then the higher level, Chirim Muchram, which is excommunicated. Sheinu Sheinu L'Achirim. So here we're upping the ante. We're turning up the heat on this guy for whatever reason. He obviously is not responding to the ostracism. And so we're turning up the heat. What is the muhram? Unlike the ostracized who can learn and who can teach, she'ein she'ein l'acherim, he can no longer teach others, and we do not teach him. But he is allowed to study Torah himself so that he doesn't forget his studies. Why do we have to say that? Because we saw that he's being treated like a mourner, and a mourner is not supposed to study Torah. So even though he's being treated like a mourner, we allow him to study Torah because otherwise he will forget his Torah study. He's not hired, and one is not allowed to be hired by him. One doesn't do business with him. We deal with him for the bare minimum necessary for his livelihood. Number six, Mishi Yashav Benidui Shleishim Yaim, somebody who was in a state of ostracism for 30 days, V'loi Bikesh La'atiroi, and he doesn't come to the court and say, you know what, I want to have this released, what do I got to do? Menadin Oisi Shnia, so we put him in ostracism for a second 30-day period. So what we see from Rambam is, the way this is supposed to work, the person is supposed to say, I realize I made a mistake, I'm coming to the court, I want to make good, and I want to be forgiven, I want to be released from this ostracism. By the way, I just remembered another example of one of the 24 people that receive excommunication. There's somebody who calls somebody else a slave. If you call somebody else a slave, you get excommunication. So if he doesn't come and say, you know, I'm going to try to make this person, I'm going to save, give, make amends, ask for forgiveness. If he just says he's stubborn, like we saw before with the stone, he's stubborn, you put me in ostracism, no problem. I don't like people anyway. So he's stubborn, and he's in his 30-day ostracism, and he doesn't seem to mind. So we give him another 30 days. Yashav Shloshim Yom Achirim, if now it's 60 days, v'loy bikesh latir, and he doesn't ask for it to be released, machrim noisi. That's when we take it, we turn up the heat, and we put him in chirim, which is this more severe level of ostracism called excommunication. You see from the Rambam is the very act of coming and asking, I would like to be released, this is already showing some humility and the seeking for reconciliation. But as the commentators point out, clearly there are things like if he hasn't accepted the ruling of the court, right? We said one of the reasons a person might be excommunicated, one of the 24 things, is somebody who refuses to accept the ruling of the court. So if he's still refusing to accept the ruling of the court, it doesn't matter that he asks to be released. He has to do the ruling of the court. We'll see later in the Rambam that a person could be released from the ostracism immediately as long as he comes around. In some cases, it's a punishment, and so it's going to go for 30 days even if he says, I'm sorry. But in certain cases, it's purely to get him to do something. So once he does it, there's no need for the ostracism. Number seven, how many people do you need to release a person from ostracism or excommunication? The answer is you only need three people. Even if they're not major experts, they're not judges, they're not great Torah scholars, they're hediotot, just three, it's fine. That creates a court. If you have a person who is an expert, who is an expert judge, then he can do it all by himself. He doesn't need three. He can release a person from ostracism or excommunication. Now we, this last piece of the Rambam, piece of this law from the Rambam is that typically we have a law that a student is supposed to have a certain level of respect for his teacher, and one of those, one of the signs of respect is that in the place where his teacher is, the student defers. He doesn't make any rulings. He says, you know, my teacher's in charge over here, not me. So you got to go to the teacher. But when it comes to releasing somebody from ostracism who deserves to be released, we don't want to postpone that at all. And so we make an exception to the rule where generally the student has to defer to the teacher. And we say, if the teacher is not available, the student can release the person from the ostracism. Why? Because we don't want to keep a person in a state of ostracism from the community, separateness from the community, for one moment longer than absolutely necessary. So this emphasizes the idea, the importance of community and being a part of the community and not keeping someone out of it for even one extra moment. Number nine. So three people, they excommunicated somebody and then they left. They moved to another country. And this person now, who is put in ostracism, has done teshuva. He has repented. For whatever, you know, let's say he had this wild dog that was a danger. He got rid of it. So three other people can come and release him from the ostracism. In other words, it doesn't have to be the same people who put him in ostracism. They don't have to be the ones who release him from it, when it's very clear what the crime was, why he was given the ostracism, then any other three people can release him from it if it's clear that he did what he had to do. Number 10, Mishila Yada Mishinidahu Yelichla Nosiviatalinidue. This is a little bit of a complicated law. The commentators have a lot to say about it, because it seems to contradict the earlier law, but let's say like this. In certain cases, when a person was excommunicated or put in ostracism, but he doesn't know who it was, we don't know who was the person who did it, then he has to go to the Nasi. He has to go to the top person in the Jewish community, the Nasi, in order to be released from the ostracism. Why? Because we have this concept. So there's different ways to explain it. One way of explaining it is that in certain cases, it's not about a specific thing that the person did, but it could be that he, we don't know why this person put him in ostracism. Could be some offense, some offensive thing that he said, or some shame that he put upon another person. In that case, we need to go to somebody who is greater than the person, or equal or greater than the person who put him in the ostracism. And since we don't know who is the person who put him in ostracism, we need to go to the top person, because then we know for sure that this is somebody who is greater than the person who ostracized him. Number 11, Nidri Al Tanai. If a ban was issued conditionally, even if one imposed that conditional ban on himself, it must be nullified. So the ban has to be nullified, even though it was done on a condition, and that even if that condition was not fulfilled. Talmud Chacham Shindatzmai, a Torah scholar who put himself in excommunication, even if he did so conditional on the consent of another person, even if he issued it because of a matter which requires judgment, how does he make philatomy? He can nullify it for himself. If he put himself in ostracism, he can nullify it himself. This is a very interesting law, number 12. And those of you who have been taking the JLI course, Jupernatural, where they had a whole class about dreams and whether dreams are meaningful or not meaningful, this halacha is very relevant to that topic. Here's what it says. Mishinidu b'chaloim. Somebody who has a dream, and in the dream, he's placed under a ban of ostracism. In the dream. Afilu yada minidahu, even if he knows who the person in the dream is, let's say that person is alive. Can he just go to that person and be released from the ban? Answer is no. Tzarech asara b'nei adam sheshoinin halachis latimidei. He needs to go to 10 people who study Talmud in order to be released from this ban of ostracism. Let me finish the halacha, and then I'll go back to why this is the case. V'im loy matza, if he can't find 10 people who are proficient in Talmud study, tireach achreim at parsa, he has to go and travel to find them, up to 2.3 miles, what is called a parsa, which is 12,000, approximately 12,000 feet or 8,000 cubits. So he's got to travel 2.3 miles approximately to try to find these scholars. Loi motza, if he didn't find scholars of that level, matirim le'afilu asar sheina mishnah. So he can find 10 people who are at lower level of scholarship. They're not proficient in Talmud, but they're proficient in Mishnah. Loi motza, if he hasn't found even at that level, matirim le'asar sheyedim likras batera. So he, as long as he finds 10 who can read Torah, they're proficient in reading Torah. They're not proficient in Mishnah, but at least they're proficient in Torah, in the written Torah, in Bible. Those 10 can also release him from the ban of ostracism that he received in the dream. Loi motza, if he can't even find that, matim lefil sashin in lukeris. So any 10 Jews can release him from the ostracism, even if they don't know how to read Torah. Le'matzavim kaveh, if he can't find 10. Sounds like Abraham and God fighting over the Sodom. If he can't find 10, matin le'afilu shleisha. Then even if he finds three people, and they can release him from this ban. Now, why is it that when somebody is ostracized in a dream, that we have to go through this whole process of finding 10 people to release him from the dream, release him from the ostracism of the dream? Anybody have a suggestion? Anybody guess? Okay, I'll tell you. The way it's explained is that when something is told to a person in a dream, we are concerned that this is coming from God. That the dream is a message from God. And so you can't just do the regular thing where you go to three people and they say, okay, machul, 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 you're forgiven, you're released, because this is something coming from God. We need something more serious to do the release. And that's why you need a minion, just like you need a minion to say Kaddish, to read from the Torah and so forth. Why? Because the minion the presence of 10 together welcomes the divine presence. And that's why you need the 10. This is why you need the 10, because the ostracism came through a dream and we're concerned that this is a real excommunication coming from heaven. So it requires a heavenly presence, a divine presence of the 10 people together to release this person from his ostracism that he received in the dream. Interesting, the Rambam doesn't mention it, but what if he has a dream that he's been released from the ostracism? It doesn't help. Why? Because we don't know if the second dream is a real dream or it's just an imaginary thing. I mean, it's a real dream, but we don't know if it was a real message or if he's just imagining this message. And maybe the first one was a real message, but not the second one. Therefore, he has to go through this process of getting the 10 men. Number 13, Mishinidu Bafanov, Imatin Le'el Bafanov. Somebody is ostracized in front, in his presence. Imatin Le'el Bafanov, when he is released from it, it should be done in his presence. Why is that? Because if he's released from the ostracism and he doesn't know about it, when he comes and people are just treating him like regular, it's going to be odd. He's not going to understand why is he not still being treated as if he's in ostracism, because he doesn't know that he's been released. So to avoid that, we make sure that he knows that he has been released from ostracism and he is released from it in his presence. But if he received the ostracism and he wasn't present, then there's no problem with releasing him from it, and he's not present. There's no minimum time between being ostracized and being released from it. It could be, says the Rambam, that a person could be ostracized and then released from ostracism berega echad, in one moment. So he's only been in ostracism for one moment and he's already released. Why? If the excommunicated person is repents and does what he has to do, then he is released from the nidui immediately. If the court sees that this person is not repenting and he's not showing any sign of remorse, then they might leave him in that state for many years according to his wickedness. And if they decide right from the outset, in other words, we learn that first you start off with a 30-day lower level ostracism, then you give him another 30 days of ostracism. If that doesn't work, then you turn up the heat, you give him the excommunication. But the Rambam is telling us now that if the court sees what's happening, they judge the situation, they see, you know, we better hit this guy right away with the cherem. Let's hit him with the cherem right away. They can do that. They can also extend this. Anybody who eats with this person and drinks with this person is also going to become excommunicated. Or anybody who stands in within 6 cubits, machrimin, they can do that in order to punish him, in order to create a fence for the Torah so that the sinners do not... So it is not violated by the sinners. Okay, so there the Rambam takes care of these laws of excommunication, and now he gets back to the Talmid Chacham, which is really the subject that he started with, where the sage puts people in excommunication for being disrespectful to the Torah sage. So here's what he says. Even though a Torah sage has permission to excommunicate for his own honor, and someone who disrespected his honor, he can excommunicate the person. It's not praiseworthy for a Talmud Chacham, for a Torah sage, to do so. To behave in this way. Rather, he just ignores, he closes his ears and makes like he doesn't hear the words of this person who was shaming him. And he shouldn't pay any attention to it. Like King Shlomo said in his wisdom in Ecclesiastes, do not pay heed to all the words that are spoken. This was the way of the early pious ones. They would hear themselves being shamed and they wouldn't respond. And beyond that, they would be moichel l'macharev v'selchamle. They would forgive the person that was shaming them, who was insulting them, and they would forgive them. As we say every night before we go to sleep, Rabbeinu Shaloylam, part of the Shema before going to sleep, I forgive everybody. That came from the sages. V'chachamim gedolim, the great sages, who mishtapchim b'maseim anoyim. They would say of themselves, in their praise of themselves, they would say, I never excommunicated a person for my honor. This is the proper way of the sages that a person should follow. Now the Rambam gives us a caveat. When do we say these words? When the Torah scholar was shamed or insulted privately. Then the proper thing for him to do is ignore it and forgive. But if this happened in public, if the Torah sage was insulted and shamed publicly, then it's no longer a personal issue about him. Now it's no longer about him, it's about the honor of the Torah, the kavod of the Torah. In this case, he doesn't have the prerogative to say, I'll just ignore it, keep going. He's actually forbidden to forgo his honor. If he forgoes his honor, he will be punished. Because this is a shame to the Torah. It's a disrespect to the Torah, and therefore he has to stand up for the respect of the Torah. Interestingly, this is the Gemara in Yoma, Tractate Yoma, where this comes from. And there it talks about King Saul. that King Saul, at the beginning of his career, he was very humble and he was shamed, he was insulted by various people, and he didn't do anything about it. And that was a mistake, because it was an insult to the king, to the kingdom, to the kingship, and he should have taken steps to, it was because it was in public, he should have punished those who had done so. And so similarly, in the case of a Torah sage, he doesn't have the prerogative to say, I don't care, I'm just going to ignore it. No, this is not him, about him, is about the Torah. Rather, the Rambam concludes, he needs to seek vengeance and carry enmity. Noiter adavar is to carry enmity, kenochosh, like a snake, until the person will come and ask for forgiveness, and he will forgive him. Now, this is very interesting that it says like a snake. What does it mean, like a snake? So, already the Marsha, one of the commentators on the Gemara, he says that, when I read it, I thought snake means like you got a, like a snake, like poisonous, like, I don't know, the snake means like really bad. You know, the snake doesn't forgive. But the Marsha says that actually by saying it, that he does so like a snake, is trying to minimize the type of revenge that he's taking. And he, the way he explains it is that it says in Genesis that that there's always going to be a fight between the snake and the man. And it says the man is going to trample on your head and you're going to bite him in the heel. And so the Marsha says that you have to be like a snake, that even when the Torah scholar has to take vengeance and he has to put the person in his place for desecrating the Torah, he should do it like a snake, which is don't crush the person's head. Don't go crazy. Like the Nachash who attacks the heel, do something small, and it's actually coming to minimize what the Torah scholar is supposed to do. The Baal Shem Tov says something very beautiful. I heard this from Rabbi Jacobson. Beautiful teaching of the Baal Shem Tov. He says like this. It says in the Midrash that the snake doesn't really enjoy attacking people. And why does it do it? You know, it's in other words, a lion or the predatory animals, they attack other animals to eat them. They're hungry. They get need to eat. So they bite and they eat. And that a snake will do so even if it has no pleasure out of it, no benefit from it. And the Medrash says that the reason for it is because the snake is sometimes fulfilling a divine mission, and it has nothing, there's nothing in it for the snake. It's simply a shaliach, it's an agent to fulfill God's will. And so the Baal Shem Tov said, some quoted from the Baal Shem Tov, some quoted from later, the Baal Shem Tov said that when a person has to do this, when a Torah sage has to do this, has to stand up for the honor of the Torah and take vengeance, he has to be very, very careful, because it's a very tricky thing, a very sensitive thing. Why is it sensitive? Because sometimes a person thinks that he's standing up for the respect of the Torah, but really he's just standing up for his own ego. So if you're standing up for your own ego, then you're not supposed to do it. You're not supposed to attack people for your ego. So he has to be very careful that he's like the Nachash who does what he has to do as a mission from God. This is what the Torah requires, not and for any pleasure or satisfaction that the person might be getting from taking revenge on another person. And so the Rambam sums up the whole, it seems like an odd way, at first blush, it seems like an odd way to sum up all the laws of Talmud Torah. The laws of Talmud Torah end with the Torah sage taking vengeance like a snake. But according to the teaching of the Baal Shem Tov, is actually very beautiful, that all of this about the honor that the Torah sage is supposed to have, we have to be very careful that it's never about the ego and Torah study in general. We have to be very careful. We have to be vigilant that it doesn't become an ego trip for the sage, but rather recognizing that he is in the service of Torah, and in the service of Torah, he needs to do what he has to do. That concludes chapter 7 and all of the laws of Talmud Torah. We'll open it up to questions and or comments.